This is a Triple J podcast.
Hey, it's Dave Mark Hazy with your long listen for the week. And a bit of a warning before we get right into this one. This chart is not pretty. It's not a nice listen, but it could be one of the most important things that you listen to, because it's about what is being called the most immediate threat to humanity. Nuclear war. What is nuclear war? What does that mean? It's a threat that's loomed over the world for decades, and we've obviously seen the devastating impacts of nuclear weapons in the past, the obliteration of communities in Japan etched into our memories. Could that happen again? Well, it's a question worth asking with all the talk about nuclear weapons at the moment. Just think, US President Donald Trump announcing recently he'd directed his administration to immediately resume nuclear testing. We've had Russia responding, saying if that happens, it'll carry out its own tests. Then we've got tensions building between India and Pakistan, two more nuclear-armed states. So how volatile is this situation? The man you're going to hear from now can tell you. The group he set up, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, was actually awarded a Nobel Peace Prize in 2017. And what he's got to say, it is a hard listen.
A nuclear war could happen essentially any time, and that would very likely end the kind of world and our civilization, you know, in an afternoon.
He explains what Australia's role in all of this is.
So it's possible that we could, within a year or two, actually be a base of operations for launch of US nuclear weapons.
But he's also going to offer some hope.
No people who have ever lived on this good earth have ever had the opportunity to do so much good, to protect everything they love, all the labour of past generations, all the magnificent fruits of human endeavour and civilisation.
So here it is, my chat with Australian Professor Tilman Ruff. Professor Ruff, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks very much. Pleasure to be with you.
Look, it's a big topic, and it's a dark one as well, and something maybe a lot of people would prefer not to be thinking too much about. But does the potential of nuclear war keep you up at night? Is it something you're constantly thinking about?
Well, I have to say yes. I've made that my life's work, really, because it is really the most acute kind of existential threat we face. Like, if a nuclear war could happen essentially any time, and that would very likely end the kind of world, the habitable planet with this wonderful creation and all this biodiversity and our civilization, you know, in an afternoon.
Yeah, when we think about the biggest threats to humanity, climate change is usually at the top of the list. That's what everyone's attention goes to immediately. But in your view, is nuclear war a bigger threat than the climate crisis at the moment?
Look, I think they're both really big and really urgent. The impacts of the climate crisis will come over time, and there is still potential for significant parts of that to be reversed. But for nuclear war, it would be really abrupt. It would be essentially over within a day or so. Nuclear war has the potential for essentially to do what happened when this huge meteorite hit the Earth 66 million years ago that wiped out the dinosaurs and three quarters of the other species that lived on Earth. And it should be the most easily preventable of these. The climate crisis is actually harder to deal with. We have to do both of these things. They're both urgent, and they make each other worse. Most people may not think about nuclear war as a climate issue, and it really is, because our climate, the safe and hospitable sort of range of climate that we need, needs to be protected from both uncontrolled heating, but it also needs to be protected from essentially the ice age conditions that would be brought on, you know, within a week or two, if nuclear war happened.
Some really sobering stuff from you there in terms of just how immediate the impact of a nuclear weapon would be. Has there ever been much research into what would happen if one was used against us in Australia, if we had a nuclear weapon drop here?
Yes, there's quite a lot of evidence about what nuclear weapons would do, particularly single or, you know, a few nuclear weapons, apart from the bitter experience that you mentioned in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the first time that 80 years ago nuclear weapons were used in war. Those were two, by today's standards, relatively small tactical-sized nuclear weapons, so respectively 15,000 and 21,000 tonnes of high explosive equivalent. That's more than 1,000 times bigger just in terms of the explosive power than the largest conventional weapons. So these are gargantuan in terms of just their explosive potential, but of course then they also have the capacity to ignite very widespread fires and to release radioactivity, which spreads indiscriminately on the wind and comes down with the rain. All the evidence suggests that if the nuclear threshold is crossed, that is, if nuclear weapons are used again, it will not be one weapon, that it's very likely to escalate pretty quickly and probably largely uncontrollably. So within hours, it's likely to lead to very large-scale use, like hundreds or thousands of nuclear weapons. And that would have global ramifications of really profound significance, really in every sphere of human activity. Probably the most important of those impacts are the climate impacts, actually. If the largest modern nuclear weapons, which are several thousand times bigger than the Hiroshima bomb, were used on a city, you're talking about an area of about 1,600 square kilometres. So in a major Australian city, that would be about 23 kilometres in every direction, would be burned comprehensively over 800 degrees, most of the oxygen consumed, very powerful winds. Essentially nothing could survive within that zone. And those urban fires would lift millions of tons of black sooty smoke up into the atmosphere beyond the lower part of the atmosphere where there's rain and clouds that washes stuff out, right up into the stratosphere and higher, where it would get hot and smoky. It would deplete the ozone that protects us from ultraviolet radiation. The smoke would spread around the globe, would last for about a decade, and would make it colder, darker, and drier underneath that cloud. That would decimate agriculture globally. So in some areas in the northern latitudes, northern Europe, Russia, China, Korea, Japan, Canada, you basically couldn't grow any food anymore at all. And even from a relatively small nuclear war in nuclear terms, so for example, what could happen between an India-Pakistan war, a couple of hundred nuclear weapons targeted on their cities would put somewhere between 10 and 40 million tons of sooty black smoke up into the atmosphere. And that would potentially starve up to 2 billion people or even more just over the next couple of years.
That's really upsetting to hear, Tilman. But I mean, that's the research that's been done into the impact. It sounds like what you're saying there is it has the potential, nuclear war, to completely wipe out humanity.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
In comparison with other points in history, how big is the threat of nuclear war now?
The threat of nuclear war now is widely considered to be as great as it has ever been, if not greater, and unfortunately it's growing. That's not just me saying that, that's the United Nations Secretary General, the world's most senior diplomat. That's most of those who are now free to speak, who have managed nuclear weapons in the past. That's the Doomsday Clock, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. That's really probably the best known and most sort of authoritative, careful annual assessment of how we're tracking on the big issues. And this year they moved the Doomsday Clock hands to 89 seconds to midnight. So that's further forward than they've ever been before. So there's a couple of bits that, you know, why that's happening. One is that the nuclear armed states are actually all modernizing. So they're not just keeping the weapons they have, they're actually investing in new ones and the delivery systems. Secondly, they're not disarming. They have shredded, Russia and the United States, with 90% of the world's nuclear weapons, have shredded progressively just about all of the treaties, the hard-won treaties that were the fruits of the end of the first Cold War in the 80s and 90s that controlled nuclear weapons types and numbers and were successful. That process has reduced nuclear weapons numbers from their peak of 70,000 in 1986 down to about 12,240 now. That's a big reduction. That's obviously a step in the right direction, but unfortunately what we know about the effects of those weapons, that's not enough to make us substantially safer. And while the overall numbers are pretty stable in recent years, the business end of those weapons, the ones that are deployed with military forces, the ones that are on high alert, so ready to be launched within minutes of a decision, the numbers of those are increasing again.
Who has the most nuclear weapons, do we know?
most of them don't release, the nine nuclear armed states don't release publicly details, but some do. The United States is really the most transparent, but there are very robust estimates, and particularly the Federation of American Scientists produce really the best publicly known estimates. And Russia has the largest arsenal, 5,500 roughly. United States just a tad behind at just under 5,000. So between them, almost 90%. And the rest of them, something over 1,000. The most rapidly growing arsenal at the moment is in China, which is embarking on, has for several years now embarked on a pretty substantial build-up. So weapons numbers are going up again. The last treaty constraining Russian and American weapons, the New START treaty, is set to expire in February. The Russians have offered to extend it for another year. President Trump says he wants to involve the Chinese in those negotiations. They say no. Usually it takes years, many years, to negotiate these treaties. So the chance of negotiating a successor in a few months or even next year doesn't look very good. So it may well be that, you know, in a couple of months' time, there will be no constraints on the Russian and US nuclear arsenals anymore, and they could effectively double their deployed weapons within about 6 months. None of the nuclear armed states are fulfilling their binding legal obligations to disarm, even though they committed to do so more than half a century ago. We have nuclear armed states involved in wars, active wars at the moment, particularly in the Russian invasion of Ukraine, associated with nuclear threats. Israel's involvement in multiple wars in the Middle East, also associated with some nuclear threats, they certainly pose significant risks of nuclear escalation. We now live in an era where cyber warfare is increasingly common. Nuclear command and control systems are potentially vulnerable to cyber attack. We're seeing the deployment of artificial intelligence sort of beginning in military systems, including, according to the Russians, in their nuclear command and control systems. That poses all sorts of really difficult to understand and risks of that we don't even understand yet, how the involvement of artificial intelligence may introduce uncertainties and potentially make nuclear weapons easier to launch. And the climate crisis is seeing an increase in the number of armed conflicts in the world. So we're seeing more wars underway now by Red Cross estimates, about 130 armed conflicts around the world. A climate-stressed world is a more conflict-prone world, more food and water insecurity, more people on the move, more areas becoming difficult to live in because of extreme events and heat particularly. Each of those conflicts that involves a nuclear armed state poses a risk of escalation. So there's a lot of trends going in the wrong direction. Really, the only major positive development that makes it even more important is the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the first treaty that actually bans nuclear weapons.
What is Australia's stance on nuclear weapons, Tillman? Because have we ever investigated holding them ourselves? I know that the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, in the past has backed a plan to rid the world of nuclear weapons. He's really pushed that idea.
Sure. Australia's got a really checkered history. You know, we were the only nation to have mined uranium from our soil, sent it away to the United Kingdom to have it turned into nuclear weapons and to have those nuclear weapons exploded on our territory in the British nuclear tests in Australia in the 1950s and 60s. We export uranium, have done for decades, to most of the nuclear armed states under safeguards that really can't provide, you know, enduring assurance that that material will stay out of weapons. So Australian governments have claimed to be good guys on disarmament. We've signed every applicable treaty that controls nuclear weapons except for the ban treaty, a very important exception. But we're really walking two sides of the street. We're trying to have it both ways. On the one hand, consistently our leadership, defence white papers, national security strategies assert the centrality of United States nuclear weapons, so-called extended nuclear deterrence or nuclear umbrella, the idea that if Australia was under serious military threat, then it's the potential for the US to retaliate, including with nuclear weapons, against whoever's threatening us that keeps us safe. Unfortunately, what that does is that it justifies continued possession of nuclear weapons. It deters disarmament. It provides justification for proliferation by other nations, if it's good enough for Australia, you know, others that face more acute threats, you can't argue that they shouldn't have the same right. And it also makes us complicit in the possible use of nuclear weapons, because we provide facilities, particularly at Pine Gap in Central Australia and at Northwest Cape, that are sort of eyes and ears and communications channels for nuclear armed forces. So we have a complicit role. And increasingly with developments that are happening, not so much under AUKUS, but with the increasing enmeshment of Australia in US conventional and military operations, as they sort of pull back from close to China and are positioning more capacity further away, particularly in Australia, the submarines that are proposed to be based in Fremantle from 2027 might get nuclear weapons. And earlier than that, the B-52 bombers that are planned, so these are big, long-range American bombers that are planned to be on permanent rotation, which effectively means stationed at an Australian airbase, RAAF Tyndall, in the Northern Territory from next year. Some of those carry nuclear weapons, some of them don't. So it's possible that we could, within a year or two, actually be a base of operations for launch of US nuclear weapons. We've never been in that situation before. So Australia is, at the moment, I'd have to say, more part of the problem than the solution.
Does that disappoint you, knowing that Anthony Albanese, before he was elected, was pushing this idea of backing a ban on nuclear weapons, saying it would be a Labor government's priority? He actually held up your Nobel Peace Prize when he was announcing that plan. Is it disappointing to you that he hasn't followed it up with action?
Yes, it is, frankly. I'm disappointed that the previous Australian government opposed strongly the development of the ban treaty, were very actively opposing it. It was the first time that Australia has ever boycotted a disarmament negotiation involving multiple nations. I'm not proud of that. Commendably led by the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and seconded by Deputy Prime Minister Richard Marles, in 2018, at its national conference, Labor adopted a commitment in its national policy platform to sign and ratify the nuclear weapons ban treaty when in government. They've taken some baby steps in their first term towards constructively engaging with that treaty, stopping voting against it at the United Nations, sending observers, saying positive things, the foreign minister, about the importance of the treaty giving impetus to disarmament. But they haven't taken the logical next and key step of actually signalling our intention and signing the treaty.
What do you think the impact would be if Australia signed up to this treaty?
It would be hugely significant globally. It would be of enormous significance. It would be probably the most enduring international legacy of this government. We are strongly stick out like a sore thumb, really, in the region. The Southeast Asian states to our north, all of them, with the exception of Singapore, have joined up to this treaty. All of the independent Pacific nations that can have either done so or will shortly join the ban treaty. There are 34 states at present that are a bit like us. Don't have nuclear weapons, but part of the problem at the moment. Australia is the only country at the moment where the governing political party has a policy to join the ban treaty. So logically, we should be the first of those states to join. And that would be an enormous stimulus for people and governments around the world, I think, to seriously consider joining this treaty, because there's nothing in joining this treaty that is inconsistent with a continuing military alliance with other states, including nuclear-armed states. It only prohibits cooperation on nuclear weapons issues. That proof of the pudding is already there, because there are a number of US allies in our region, New Zealand, Thailand, and particularly the Philippines, continuing and increasing, especially in the case of the Philippines, their military cooperation with the United States with no impediment. It doesn't jeopardize an alliance relationship with the United States to say no to nuclear weapons.
There might be some people listening to this thinking, look, not everything always works out if you agree to get rid of nuclear weapons, like Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons in exchange for security guarantees from the US and Russia, and hasn't worked out well for them. How would you respond to that?
You know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. You can't argue that nuclear weapons are good for some and not for others. It's really a profoundly unjust imposition. If you unpack what nuclear deterrence, which is the sort of ostensible justification for nuclear weapons, means it's basically a psychological construct that relies on reliable information, rational leaders who've always got accurate information and make wise decisions and will always decide against nuclear weapons use. Against that, we've got the experience that on multiple occasions, by accident, by misjudgment, by a failure of some computer chip or technical component, or somebody sticking the wrong tape in a mainframe computer, nuclear war has almost happened. Nuclear armed states, thinking they were under attack, have begun launch procedures for nuclear weapons. So it can go wrong and go wrong catastrophically at any moment. If you were serious about deterrence, if that was the only reason to have nuclear weapons, you know, just in case, to deter somebody, then firstly, if deterrence failed, you wouldn't use them. Secondly, you might have a couple of weapons, maybe tens. You would have them in an invulnerable platform like a submarine where nobody knows where they are. You would not have them on high alert, and you would be happy to declare that I will never use nuclear weapons first. None of the nuclear armed states have those policies. They use their nuclear weapons every day to threaten and bludgeon other states to be able to conduct aggressive and illegal military interventions, like the Russian invasion of Ukraine, like previous invasions of nuclear-armed states in Iraq and Afghanistan and Vietnam and many other places, under cover of the relative impunity that nuclear weapons give them for those illegal and aggressive military actions. If Ukraine had nuclear weapons now, then I think it would only have dramatically multiplied the risks of this ongoing military conflict and raised the nuclear stakes.
Tillman, are nuclear weapons big business? Like, are there lots of individuals, companies, corporations who are profiting from the production of nuclear weapons, the retention of nuclear weapons?
Yes, nuclear weapons are really big business. The large weapons companies in particular, but some of them companies that people would be familiar with making other things like Boeing and Airbus making airplanes are also major nuclear weapons producers, Rolls-Royce. But the big defense companies, like the world spends just on modernizing and maintaining nuclear weapons, $100 billion, so roughly 150 billion Australian dollars, fairly serious money every year. Most of that goes to large corporations that make enormous profits. So there is a huge constituency of vested interests. Australian financial institutions, both banks and super funds, invest tens of billions of dollars in the companies that profit from making these god-awful weapons. You know, one very simple thing that everyone can do is to find out whether your bank and super fund does or doesn't. There's now over 110 major financial institutions and sovereign wealth funds globally that don't invest in nuclear weapons companies, controlling roughly $4 trillion in investments.
Tillman, I mean, this has been a really serious chat. I'm not going to lie, it's not been the lightest chat I've ever done. There's been some depressing themes that we've covered over the past few minutes. I'm wondering, as someone who's committed your life to this, and I'm not sure how you do this every day and go out there and talk about these really, really devastating issues, is there any kind of positive spin that you see? Like, can you see a world free of nuclear weapons in the decades ahead?
Absolutely, Dave. This can be done. This should be a relatively simple problem. You know, Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan, leaders of the Soviet Union and the United States, back in the mid-1980s, almost agreed in Reykjavik in 1986 to get rid of their nuclear weapons entirely. We could be living in a world free of nuclear weapons now if Reagan's commitment had have been solid and if both their commitments weren't undermined by their minders. We've already eliminated 85% of the weapons that at one time were built. We can do the rest. We know how to do this. Treaties that have eliminated whole classes of nuclear weapons or controlled their numbers have been successfully implemented on time. The obstacles are political, not technical. So absolutely this can be done. But these are difficult, horrible things to think about. Like, I can't think of anything more horrible to think about than nuclear weapons, actually. So yeah, it's really important for me to kind of stay grounded, stay real. But the thing that keeps me going, apart from that this is possible and needs to be done, is that although this is a really terrifying prospect, in that crisis there's also a profound opportunity. No people who have ever lived on this good earth have ever had the opportunity to do so much good, to protect everything they love and everything they value and all the labour of past generations, all the magnificent fruits of human endeavour and civilization, and to build a safe, secure world for future generations than to save the world now by addressing the climate crisis and getting rid of nuclear weapons. There's no more important or better work for anybody to feel proud about than that.
Really hopeful words to finish on. Professor Tilman Ruff, a Nobel Prize laureate, thank you very much for joining us on Hack.
Many thanks for having me, Dave.
There you have it. I mean, I can't say I feel much better before I did listening to all of that, but it's fascinating stuff and it's important information. Like, we need to be knowing what the threats are, talking about this. We do hear a lot about the threat of climate change. We don't hear so much about the threat of nuclear war. We know Professor Ruff is going to continue campaigning for a nuclear-free world, and he's going to be putting pressure on the government to live up to that promise of signing the UN treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. If there are any updates, we'll keep you posted. That's all for now. I'll catch you next time. Hack.